The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. The cover story for this edition, Democracy, Why It Will Prevail. First, we go to the back of the magazine to make sure that we get in this week's interview feature. And in this edition, it's called 9 Questions. The interview subject is Claire Smyth. Time says, the Northern Irish chef, on being named Best Female Chef, underrated British cuisine, and catering Meghan and Harry's wedding. First question. You were recently named Best Female Chef at the 50 Best Restaurants Awards, but said afterward that it was strange to distinguish between male and female chefs. Were you conflicted about accepting the accolade? Answer, no. There's still a lack of women in the industry across the board, and this was a platform to talk about it. What would I be adding to my industry by not accepting it, by not sharing my story and trying to inspire other people? Question. In your acceptance speech, you talked about the need to make restaurants a, quote, more human workplace, unquote, for staff. What did you mean? Answer. This industry traditionally has very long hours and low pay, and it's something we need to keep working on. Consumers play a part, too. They want to pay less and have more, always. I don't think they understand the link between the increased costs from taxes to pressures to buy more ethically produced food and the bottom line of a restaurant. Question. You became the first British woman to be awarded 3 Michelin stars at restaurant Gordon Ramsay in London. How did you cope with Ramsay's famously confrontational style? Answer. I found Gordon very easy to work with because you always knew where you stood. It's harder if you don't know. Gordon's not a moody person. He just tells it like it is. People don't see the same side to him that I do day to day. Question. Have you come across people who do make it difficult to work in the kitchen? Answer. When I was coming up in the industry, it was a testosterone-fueled environment. People would hide your equipment or turn your oven off in the middle of service. It was a macho culture, but it wasn't specifically targeted at women. It was a general toughening up. Hopefully, those days are long gone. Question. Do you think it's harder for women to thrive in that kind of culture? Answer. I personally don't. It was the same for everyone. I knew what I wanted to achieve, and I would never have let anyone get in the way. But maybe that's just me. I'm very headstrong. Question. The restaurant industry is having a Me Too moment with allegations of sexual misconduct against celebrity chefs. Is this a time of self-reflection for the industry? Answer. It is, and a very important one. I haven't experienced that kind of behavior, luckily, but there are a lot of people that have, and it's important they speak out about it. We should say enough is enough. Question. Do you feel a duty to help other female chefs? Answer. Definitely. I'm training a couple in my kitchen. If they can make it to the top, they can change the industry. This generation will break the mold. Question. Your new restaurant, Core, focuses on British food. Is that cuisine unfairly maligned? Answer, yes. Traditionally, haute cuisine is French, They created it, and you can't get away from it. What we have in Britain is a very strong produce culture. So we're trying to take core British ingredients, play with them, and elevate them to a fine level. Final question. You catered Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's royal wedding in May. How was that different from other jobs? Final answer. I don't think it was different. We just cooked how we cook. When I was younger, and there'd be high-profile clients, I'd panic a bit. But with maturity, you know what you're doing, and you get on with it. It was just like any other day. Interview by Sierra Nugent with Claire Smythe, Northern Irish chef, best female chef. Now returning to the front of the magazine, and we will go right to the one-page collection of tiny news items called For the Record. Each of these items is illustrated by a line drawing or a quotation in bold, and sometimes both. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount, in red, $300 million. Caption explains, estimated value of the 10-year endorsement deal that tennis star Roger Federer has signed with Uniqlo. $300 million. 10-year endorsement deal. Below that, in the right margin of the page, is a story illustrated by a quotation from Emmanuel Macron, President of France, defending his economic policies in a speech to Parliament. And the quotation from French President Emmanuel Macron, quote, if you want to share the cake, you've got to have a cake, unquote. In the lower right corner of the page is the feature within a feature called Good Week, Bad Week. At Bad Week, hot dogs. Caption explains, Costco caught flack for taking Polish hot dogs off menu. Under Good Week, burgers. Caption explains, online mentions of IHOP jumped after it briefly changed its name to IHOB to promote burgers. Running along the bottom center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Ricardo Rosello, governor of Puerto Rico, tweeting in response to a viral video that showed a woman being harassed in an Illinois park for wearing a shirt modeled on the U.S. territory's flag. And the quotation from Puerto Rican governor Ricardo Rosello, quote, this is not the America we believe in. Correction. I'll repeat that for clarity. Quote, this is not the America we all believe in. Unquote. Ricardo Rosello, governor of Puerto Rico. In the lower left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount in red, $3.5 million. Caption explains, amount of money that a federal judge ordered the U.S. Postal Service to pay the creator of the Las Vegas replica of the Statue of Liberty after a stamp was issued that accidentally showed the copy instead of the real statue. That story is also illustrated by line drawings of the two images of the Statue of Liberty. One is labeled Vegas on the left, and the other is labeled NYC on the right. Line drawings. In the center left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from China's Ministry of Commerce in a statement characterizing the effect of the $34 billion in U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods that took effect on July 6th. And a quotation from China's Ministry of Commerce, quote, the biggest trade war in economic history so far, unquote. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount in bright red, $70,000. Caption explains, approximate difference between annual pay for the Boston Symphony Orchestra's top flutist and that of its top oboist. The flutist, Elizabeth Rowe, is suing for gender pay discrimination, $70,000. In the top page, at the top of the page, is a story illustrated by a quotation from Donald Trump, President of the United States, at a NATO meeting in Brussels, where he told NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg that Europe's reliance on Russian natural gas means it is, quote, inappropriate, unquote, for the U.S. to help Germany defend itself against the source of that fuel. And the quotation from President Donald Trump, quote, Germany, as far as I'm concerned, is captive to Russia, unquote. Times goes on to say, German Chancellor Angela Merkel disputed the assertion. In the center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Ronda Rousey, former UFC women's bantamweight champion, at her induction ceremony for the UFC Hall of Fame, of which she is the first female member. And the quotation from Ronda Rousey, quote, we have changed what it means to fight like a girl, unquote. That was the entire page for the record. Moving ahead, and we are now in the major section called The Brief. And we have a feature within that section called News Ticker, a sidebar, and it consists of three news items stacked top to bottom. Top item, nerve agent kills woman in the UK. British police have launched a murder investigation after a 44-year-old woman died from exposure to Novichok, the military-grade Soviet-era nerve agent used to poison former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter in March. The UK has called on Russia to explain the poisonings. Middle item, Trump administration suspends Obamacare payments. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said on July 7th that a February court ruling would force it to halt risk adjustment payments to insurers, a part of the Affordable Care Act meant to stabilize markets. Health insurers said the move could cause premiums to spike. Final item, Iran's arrest of dancing teen draws protest. Iranian authorities face a backlash after detaining a teenager who posted Instagram videos of herself dancing in her room without a headscarf, mandatory in public in Iran. Dozens of women shared videos of themselves dancing in public after state TV broadcast Mehdi Hojabri's apparent confession. Moving ahead, and we come to the milestones page. Lead item, under died, Tab Hunter, trailblazing heartthrob. Observance written by Pamela Adlon. Time explains, Adlon is an actor, writer, and producer currently starring on Better Things on FX. She writes, I met Tab Hunter when I was about 14. All I knew was that he was this big movie star from back in the day. I didn't really know of his history beyond that, but I was the only kid in Grease 2, and he was so kind to me. When everybody was hanging out together, I was a little bit on the outside, but Tab would be in his trailer, needle-pointing, and he taught me how. He told me that his friend Rosie Greer had taught him. The fact that Rosie Greer taught him and then he was teaching me made me feel like I was part of an amazing circle of life. I was being modeled a soft, gentle man in a hard, bronzed, matinee idol exterior. Tab, who died on July 8th at 86, was so sweet and so generous, and just a lovely man. The cast of Grease 2 just had its 35-year reunion in March, which is how long Tab and his partner Alan Glazer had been together. And I couldn't go, but the very next day I ran into Tab and Alan at a restaurant. We took a picture, and when he put his arms around me, he was still like an oak tree. In addition to his film career, he was a pioneer. He didn't necessarily want to come out when he did, but he took control of it. I can't even imagine what it must have been like to be living within that studio system and not be able to live as your true self. Living your truth that way gives you power, and his story is going to mean so much to people who are marginalized. I think that people are going to discover him now. I'm just sad he's going to miss it. Pamela Adlon on Tab Hunter. This item is accompanied by a full-color photograph of Tab Hunter. Caption says, Hunter was best known as a Hollywood idol in the 1950s, starring in movies such as Battle Cry and The Burning Hills. Also under died, Claude Lanzmann, filmmaker. Observance by Stephanie Zakaric. She writes, when French filmmaker Claude Lanzmann's 9 1/2 hour Holocaust documentary, Shoah, opened in 1985, the mere act of seeing it was a badge of honor. Lanzmann spent 12 years on the project, amassing 350 hours of interview footage with survivors, perpetrators, and witnesses. The Time critic Richard Corliss wrote of the film in 1985, quote, the viewer is grateful to have made the forced march with Lanzmann. We still have much to learn about the poison in our hearts, unquote. Lanzmann, who died on July 5th at age 92, didn't flinch from that poison. As a teenager, he smuggled small arms for the French resistance. For Shoah, he immersed himself in the horrible details of the Holocaust. He knew the exact dimensions of the gas chambers and familiarized himself with the precise killing mechanisms of the SS. Like all men and all artists, Lanzmann had his imperfections and blind spots. But he delved into noble work. The sins of the world were his fixation, and it was those he sought to capture on film. Stephanie Zakaric writing about Claude Lanzmann. On this page, under died, comic book artist Steve Ditko, who helped create Spider-Man, at 90 on June 29th. Police announced his death on July 7th. Under christened, Prince Louis, the third child of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, in a private ceremony on July 9th, conducted by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Under overruled, an order for Brazil's former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, to be released from jail while he appeals a corruption conviction by the head of an appeals court. Lula's status has caused an uproar as the country heads into elections later this year. Under allowed, plaintiffs in a lawsuit seeking to block a citizenship status question from the 2020 U.S. Census to gather evidence from the Trump administration about why the question was created by a judge in New York. The suit has cast doubt on officials' initial explanations. Under announced, the discontinuation of Peanuts, an iconic airplane snack, by Southwest Airlines on August 1st, out of concern for those with allergies, the company said, July 9th. Under set, a new record for fastest cargo trip to the International Space Station by Russia, when its Progress 70 spacecraft landed on July 9th, less than 4 hours after lifting off. That was the entire contents of the milestones page. On the facing page is another version of the feature within a feature news ticker. Again, it is a sidebar with three news items stacked on top of the other. Top item, Charlottesville subject pleads not guilty. James Alex Fields, Jr., accused of killing Heather Heyer and injuring others by driving into a crowd of counter-protesters during an August 2017 white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, pleaded not guilty to federal hate crime charges on July 5th. He also faces other charges, including murder in Virginia. Middle item. Fuel price hike causes unrest in Haiti. Haitian leaders were forced to suspend planned increases in fuel prices on July 7th after demonstrations against them turned violent in two cities. Part of a deal with the Information Monetary Fund, part of a deal with the International Monetary Fund, the measures were set to raise the prices of gasoline, diesel, and kerosene by 38%, 48%, and 51%, respectively. Final item. Tesla plans Chinese plant as tariffs kick in. Tesla has reached a deal to build a factory in Shanghai that it says will produce 500,000 electric cars annually in 2 to 3 years, rivaling its U.S. capacity. The move comes as the ongoing trade dispute between President Donald Trump and Beijing led Tesla to raise its prices in China this month. Moving forward, we're now at the next major section. It's called The View. The subsection here is Society. And the headline is, What Mother Doesn't Know, by Susanna Schwabsdorf. There may be nobody as vulnerable to manipulation as a mother worried about her child's health. The question of whether we're doing right by our kids cuts straight to the maternal heart. The problem is that in this age of marketing versus activism, we're overwhelmed and paralyzed by the debates about what's best. It's not surprising, then, that there was an uproar when the New York Times reported on July 8th that the Trump administration had tried to dilute a resolution at the World Health Assembly this spring that called on all nations to, quote, protect, promote, and support breastfeeding, unquote. The effort failed, but the U.S. delegation was accused of favoring the interests of formula companies over the health of children when it objected to that seemingly mild language, as well as restrictions on marketing breast milk substitutes to mothers. As we've seen in the debates over abortion or plastic surgery or pregnancy nutrition, everyone has an opinion about what women should and should not do with their bodies, even if they don't inhabit a female body themselves. And that's especially true when there's a $45 billion global business like infant formula at stake. Standing in opposition to that revenue number are the health advocates who have fought for decades to increase breastfeeding everywhere and decrease misleading infant formula marketing practices, particularly where lack of access to uncontaminated water can make using powdered formula life-threatening. Experts point out that the overwhelming evidence of the health benefits linked to nursing, a lower risk for asthma, obesity, type 2 diabetes, sudden infant death syndrome, and ear and respiratory infections, extend to all countries. Despite all that data, the U.S. has consistently lagged behind most high-income countries on both breastfeeding rates, parenthetically, only about half of American women are still breastfeeding at 6 months, as is recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the policies that help increase them, like paid maternity leave. I'll repeat that sentence without the parenthetical interjection for clarity. Despite all that data, the U.S. has consistently lagged behind most high-income countries on both breastfeeding rates and the policies that help increase them, like paid maternity leave. The current administration's move in some ways echoes 1981, when the U.S. was the only dissenting vote, with 118 countries in favor of adopting rules that would prevent formula companies from giving away their products to new mothers and targeting them with aggressive marketing strategies. World Health Organization experts believed these methods were linked to a dramatic increase in mortality, malnutrition, and diarrhea in very young infants in developing nations. President Trump responded by pointing out that his administration is not anti-breastfeeding, but in favor of giving women more choice, an exquisitely Trumpian way of co-opting the left's script. Caitlin Oakley, a spokeswoman for the Department of Health and Human Services, added in a statement that women who can't breastfeed should not be, quote, stigmatized, unquote, but rather, quote, equally supplied with information, unquote. Many American women agree, saying the cultural mandate to breastfeed, no matter their personal circumstances, and zealous hospital lactation programs is another example of how women's bodies are not their own to manage. It's true that the experts don't mince words. Dr. Colleen A. Kraft, president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, has said that, quote, the decision to breastfeed is not a lifestyle choice. It's a critical decision for infant welfare, unquote. And part of the World Health Organization's recommendations on marketing is to have the formula products carry messages about the, quote, risks of not breastfeeding, unquote. This is where the conflict lies. Who has the authority to say when a lack of benefit is dangerous? It's one thing to hear that breastfeeding gives your baby a slew of health rewards, and a different thing to hear that formula feeding could be risky. These decisions are made more fraught by hyper-targeted digital marketing about nursing and all the other hot debates. Whether to vaccinate a child or not, to medicate them for ADHD, and the many other questions for which there is no one answer. And so, mothers try to filter out the flotsam and the hype, always knowing that someone will think they're wrong, and that needing to choose is the one thing we don't have a choice about. That was the entire article by Susanna Schwabsdorf, and Time Notes with reporting by Alexandra Sifferlin in New York and Naina Bajakal in London. We come now to the sidebar feature called Reading List. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. It lists three items stacked on top of each other. Top item, how a Supreme Court shift may impact LGBTQ rights. Jim Oberfell, the lead plaintiff in the U.S. Supreme Court case that made same-sex marriage legal nationwide, describes how the ruling finally made him, quote, feel like an equal American, unquote. But the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the decision, makes him fear for the fate of that progress. Middle item, the keys to winning every argument. Walter Sinnott Armstrong, author of the new book, Think Again, makes the case that to start, we should stop thinking of arguing as fighting, which undermines the use of reason, damages our ability to learn from debates, and makes people try to avoid such conversations. Bottom item, how Trump should handle Vladimir Putin. American-born financier Bill Browder, who has led a global campaign to expose Putin regime abuses, writes ahead of the July 16th summit that the Russian leader will lie, flatter, and betray. Quote, the only way to deal with Putin is to contain him, not to engage him, unquote. On the facing page is a sidebar item entitled History, and the headline is How Plastic Straws Became So Popular. On July 9th, Starbucks said that by 2020, it would stop using plastic straws, which have drawn criticism for their pollution of oceans. Ironically, their ubiquity was originally the product of another do-good effort. Legend holds that in the late 19th century, a mint julep-loving Washington, D.C. businessman was so bothered by the plant-based straws of the time that would disintegrate in his drink. Yes, literal straws, that he created a paper and wax version. At about the same time, public health campaigners raged against the drinking cups left at water fountains for all to use, which spread disease. Disposable cups remained too expensive, but the new single-use straws became essential. The plastic version's popularity jumped in the post-World War II years, as plastic became cheaper, as did fast food meals, with sodas in to-go cups with crosshairs that tore apart flimsier paper straws. Today, while it's difficult to count, some say the U.S. alone uses 500 million disposable straws daily. Starbucks decided that our addiction to single-use tubes was the last straw. That item was written by Emmalin Rood, author of Tastes Like Chicken, A History of America's Favorite Bird. Moving ahead, we are now in the section called Nation, where the headline is Trump's Justice, How Brett Kavanaugh Could Change America, by Brian Bennett. President Trump had narrowed his list of contenders for the nation's highest court to four by the time Air Force One touched down outside Washington on July 8th. But Trump wanted another sit-down with one candidate in particular. That evening at the White House, Trump spent more than an hour in his private residence talking with Brett Kavanaugh about the judge's family, his life growing up in the Capitol with two lawyers as parents, and his work, according to a person familiar with the discussion. It was the longest amount of time Trump had spent with any of the candidates. After their discussions, Trump said Kavanaugh was a judge, quote, out of central casting, unquote, one of the president's favorite compliments. The meeting led directly to the East Room of the White House the following night, where Trump announced Kavanaugh's nomination beneath gleaming chandeliers. There, Kavanaugh needed only 14 words to describe his approach to the bench. Quote, a judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. Unquote. That simple sentence was more than just a judicial philosophy. It reflected the culmination of two distinct efforts at judicial mentoring, which came together in Kavanaugh's nomination. One was a four-decade effort by an entire generation of conservatives to bend the court away from judicial activism. The other was a patient education and corralling of Trump by a handful of Republican legal elites. The intrigue surrounding the selection was, of course, classic Trump, from an interview process that resembled a matchmaking show to the pageantry of the prime time announcement. But the choice will have far-reaching consequences for America's 325 million citizens. If confirmed, Kavanaugh, 53, could solidify a conservative majority on the court for decades. During his 12 years on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, he has issued some 300 opinions that reflect his reputation on both sides of the aisle as a solid and careful judge. Democrats warn that his conservative record suggests he will bolster the pro-business leaning on the court, advance efforts to strip power from regulatory agencies, slow the expansion of gay rights, strengthen gun rights, and open the door for states to chip away at access to abortion. No single justice steers the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh's influence will take years to measure and depends on which cases come before him. Protests from Democrats that Kavanaugh would help overturn the seminal abortion decision Roe v. Wade ignore the court's deference to precedent. Kavanaugh himself said during his 2006 confirmation hearings for the lower court that Roe was already decided, although Supreme Court justices can chart a new direction in ways lower courts cannot. But there is little question that his conservative jurisprudence would have a major impact, given Kavanaugh's intellect, work ethic, and reputation for clarity in his opinions. That body of writing persuaded Trump and his conservative advisors that Kavanaugh would remain a stalwart originalist on the bench. Some observers wonder if Trump may have fixated on one point of view in particular. Kavanaugh, who was part of independent counsel Kenneth Starr's investigation of President Bill Clinton, and later served more than 5 years in President George W. Bush's White House, is an ardent believer in executive power. In a 2009 Law Review article, he called for Congress to pass a law stating that sitting presidents should not be subject to criminal investigations or civil suits while in office, adding that the Constitution prescribes the impeachment process as the remedy for ousting a wayward president. That view has obvious implications for Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Trump's ties to Russia during the 2016 campaign. If the justices are asked to decide whether Trump can be subpoenaed or charged with a crime in office, it's clear where Kavanaugh is likely to stand. Kavanaugh's path to the East Room accelerated in November 2017, when his name was added to Trump's public list of prospective Supreme Court nominees. The judges were vetted by Leonard Leo, executive vice president of the Conservative Federalist Society, and Trump's top outside legal advisor. The arrangement was clear. Trump would cede considerable power to shape the court to take the conservative legal establishment and in doing so cement his support from Republicans who were otherwise skeptical of a politician who once proclaimed his belief in abortion rights. Former White House strategist Stephen Bannon took to calling this transaction, quote, the process, unquote. And the selection of Kavanaugh like conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch last year, quote, shows the process is working, unquote, Bannon tells Time. Even more than Gorsuch, whose mother once ran the Environmental Protection Agency, Kavanaugh is a creature of Washington. He was born to two parents who brought their legal lessons to the family dinner table. Kavanaugh's mother was one of D.C.'s few female prosecutors at the time and later became a judge. When Kavanaugh joined the bench more than a decade later, he hung a framed copy of her investiture documents on the wall next to his desk. Like Gorsuch, Kavanaugh attended Georgetown Preparatory School, a rigorous Jesuit school. He earned degrees from Yale College and Yale Law School, and clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy alongside Gorsuch before joining Starr's investigation into Clinton. Kavanaugh helped write the final Starr report, which recommended Clinton's impeachment for lying about his sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. With the presidential race between Al Gore and George W. Bush deadlocked in 2000, Kavanaugh joined the GOP legal team demanding an end to the Florida recount. Less than a year later, he was working inside the Bush White House, alongside his now wife, Ashley, when jetliners struck the Twin Towers and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. Parenthetically, the two had had their first date the day before. Kavanaugh served in the White House counsel's office and as Bush's staff secretary, a demanding job requiring meticulous, close reading of every document that crosses the president's desk. In 2003, Bush nominated Kavanaugh for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, but Senate Democrats opposed him for a resume that appeared too partisan. He was finally confirmed in a 57-36 vote in 2006. On the court, Kavanaugh developed a reputation as a diligent judge who often combed through dozens of drafts for even routine opinions, says Roman Martinez, who clerked for Kavanaugh in 2008 and 2009, and recalls a boss who wanted memos and briefs to be accompanied by thick black binders filled with every law review article on the topic. As opinions mounted, the binders, stacked up in the kitchenette in Kavanaugh's chambers. Kavanaugh is, quote, one of the most serious judges I've ever encountered. He's a much more disciplined judge than the man he's replacing, unquote, says Lawrence Silberman, a senior judge on the D.C. Circuit, echoing criticism of Kennedy's sometimes unpredictable arguments. Kavanaugh's rulings reflect skepticism that government agencies have the power to issue regulations that stretch beyond what Congress has passed. He looked askance at several Obama-era environmental protections, including attempts to limit air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, and dissented in a 2015 decision upholding a regulation that required religious organizations to notify the government if they were not providing or paying for contraceptives under the Affordable Care Act. Kavanaugh argued that filing the forms would make the organization complicit and violate religious freedom rights. The page we are leaving contains this insert entitled Brett Kavanaugh Fast Facts. There are three items. Top item. Beltway background. Kavanaugh was raised in the D.C. area and is a favorite of the city's conservative legal establishment. Next item, court connection. Like President Trump's first pick, Neil Gorsuch, Kavanaugh went to Georgetown Preparatory School and clerked for Justice Kennedy. Final item, political player. He worked on the 2000 Florida recount and in the George W. Bush White House. Resuming the article exactly where we left off, on gun rights, Kavanaugh has taken a broad reading of the Second Amendment, writing in a 2011 dissent that the District of Columbia should not be allowed to ban semi-automatic rifles and high-capacity magazines. Kavanaugh argued it was unconstitutional because similar weapons are commonly used in the U.S. As someone who grew up in Washington in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, quote, "I am acutely aware of the gun, drug, and gang violence that has plagued all of us," unquote, Kavanaugh wrote. Quote, "But our task is to apply the Constitution and the precedents of the Supreme Court, regardless of whether the result is one we agree with as a matter of first principles or policy," unquote. Concerns that Kavanaugh may help chip away at reproductive rights stem largely from a 2017 case in which an undocumented teenager at a Texas detention center sought an abortion after arriving in the U.S. 8 weeks pregnant and was initially denied one due to the new policies of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which prohibits them without the director's approval. With the help of a guardian, the teenager challenged the policy as an unconstitutional burden. A lower court ruled in the teenager's favor, which the government challenged. The D.C. Circuit ultimately allowed the procedure to go forward, but Kavanaugh dissented, arguing that the majority had created, quote, "a new right for unlawful immigrant minors in U.S. government detention to obtain immediate abortion on demand," unquote. A number of cases related to abortion are moving through lower courts, and in the years to come, the Supreme Court may decide to consider, for example, whether a woman can abort a fetus with an abnormality, or where restrictions can be placed on a second trimester abortion procedure. Leah Littman, an assistant professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Irvine, says Kavanaugh's decision in the Texas case portends a, quote, "jurisprudence that will whittle away at access to abortion for women," unquote. That does not necessarily mean that Kavanaugh would help overturn Roe in the event that a case makes its way to the Supreme Court. During his 2006 confirmation hearings, Kavanaugh told senators that Roe had, quote, "been reaffirmed many times," unquote, and he would, quote, "faithfully and fully," unquote, follow the decision. Quote, "That would be binding precedent of the court," unquote, he said at the time. Quote, "It's been decided," unquote. Legal scholars and politicos have also been scrutinizing Kavanaugh's expansive interpretation of executive powers. Of all the judges Trump considered, quote, "Kavanaugh has the most robust view of presidential powers and immunities," unquote, says Jonathan Turley, a constitutional law professor at George Washington University. Indeed, Kavanaugh's 2009 Minnesota Law Review article seems to speak directly to the uncomfortable position in which Trump finds himself, a sitting president, under investigation. Kavanaugh said his experience working on Starr's investigation convinced him that presidents should have immunity from all civil and criminal investigations during their tenure. Quote, "I believe it vital that the president be able to focus on his never-ending tasks with as few distractions as possible," unquote, he wrote. Quote, "The nation certainly would have been better off if President Clinton could have focused on Osama bin Laden without being distracted by the Paula Jones sexual harassment case and its criminal investigation offshoots," unquote. In the article, Kavanaugh acknowledges the Supreme Court's 1997 ruling in Clinton v. Jones that the Constitution doesn't give presidents the opportunity to defer federal civil lawsuits during their tenure. But he urges Congress to fix the issue by passing a law allowing presidents to delay civil and criminal investigations, including sit-downs with prosecutors, until they leave the White House. If something drastic happened, he argued, the impeachment process laid out in the Constitution would be sufficient. Quote, the point is not to put the president above the law or to eliminate checks on the president, unquote, he wrote, quote, but simply to defer litigation and investigations until the president is out of office, unquote. The article, written 6 years before Trump announced his bid for the White House, will likely now take center stage during confirmation hearings. The Mueller investigation could force the court to take up, quote, a variety of legal questions about the special counsel investigation and its relationship to presidential power, unquote, says Richard Pildes, a constitutional law professor at New York University. Those range from a president's ability to pardon himself to his constitutional authority to fire Mueller to whether Trump could be compelled to testify before a grand jury. Quote, given how carefully potential nominees are vetted by the White House, it seems improbable that President Trump and his advisors aren't aware of Kavanaugh's views of presidential power, unquote, says Tara Molloy, a senior director at the Campaign Legal Center. Quote, there's no doubt his perspective was taken into consideration, unquote. Kavanaugh's long paper trail should reassure conservatives that he's unlikely to veer left should the Senate approve his lifetime appointment. But it also comes with risks, providing fodder for Democrats' campaign against him. The battle to sink the nomination began even before Kavanaugh was put forth. Democratic Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania didn't even wait to learn the nominee's name before announcing that he was a no vote. The party is painting Kavanaugh as skeptical about abortion rights and health care access. Quote, pay close attention to this nomination, unquote, Senator Kamala Harris of California warned on the steps of the Supreme Court. Quote, if you are a young woman in America, or you care about a young woman in America, pay attention to this, because it would forever change your life, unquote. Nan Aaron, the president of the Liberal Alliance for Justice, tells Time that Kavanaugh's nomination, quote, sets in motion a hard right turn for the country that may be irreversible in our lifetime, unquote. Gearing up for a grinding battle, conservatives plan to pour millions into ad campaigns supporting Kavanaugh and pressuring Senate Democrats who are up for re-election in red states this year to confirm him. Already, the conservative Judicial Crisis Network has unleashed a $1.4 million ad campaign in the backyards of Alabama's Doug Jones, Indiana's Joe Donnelly, North Dakota's Heidi Heitkamp, and West Virginia's Joe Manchin. The White House has set up a war room on the fourth floor of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building near the West Wing with a bank of computers, a large flat-screen television blaring four news channels at once, and a room that will be used for practice confirmation hearings. Quote, our strategy is to let him and his record speak for itself, unquote, says White House spokesperson Raj Shaw, who is running the press operations for the nomination. This story also is accompanied by two mini stories, each under the general heading of viewpoint. With one, the headline is Kavanaugh Will Write the Course of the Court by Jack Goldsmith. Time notes, Goldsmith is a professor of law at Harvard University and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He writes, a judge, quote, a judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law, unquote, said Judge Brett Kavanaugh during his speech accepting the nomination to replace his former boss, Anthony Kennedy, as an associate justice on the Supreme Court. This may sound like a rhetorical pose, but you should take it literally, not just seriously. Kavanaugh, whom I know primarily through his teaching at Harvard, is one of the most principled jurists I have ever studied. For fairness, your reader will now choose the first paragraph from the accompanying point of view. The headline is, A Conservative Court Will Undoubtedly Target Roe, by Jill Filipovich. Time notes, Filipovich is an attorney and the author of The H-Spot, The Affirmative Pursuit of Happiness. She writes, if appointed, Brett Kavanaugh will shift Supreme Court power rightward, with potentially dire consequences for women's rights. Roe v. Wade, the 1973 case that legalized abortion across the U.S., has become a litmus test for nominees. While liberal judges pledge to uphold Roe, conservative ones, like Kavanaugh, often resort to vague responses about respecting precedent, giving moderate Republican senators in this case, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, a guilt-free green light. Your reader included paragraph one of each of these viewpoints from Goldsmith and then from Filipovich. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We certainly hope you've enjoyed this, and please be sure to listen next time. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. I will repeat that. TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138, and I'll repeat that, 919-832-5138. And this is your loyal reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you for joining us, and again, too, thanking you for your patience with your humble reader. Please join us next time for a better version of Time Magazine.